ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Space, the cosmos, as mere earthlings, it has always captivated and bewildered us. Some of us are lucky enough to travel up into the big out there. And as NASA prepares to return humans to the moon for the first time in half a century, today on Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, hello, I've got no less than four star astronauts for you, including Australia's first female astronaut and the first to qualify under the Australian flag, the 2026 Australian of the Year, Catherine Bennell Pegg from the Australian Space Agency.
Around the world today, we have a lot of challenges. I think we all know that, whether it's climate, whether it's human society and quality of life, emergencies and so on, or political, we need to have more STEM professionals. We need to have more people that can identify and solve problems and have the tools to be able to do that as a society and to have a STEM literate society. And what human spaceflight does is it is a gateway for many young people to fall in love with science, to fall in love with innovating and being creative and being empowered to be at that forefront of discovery and solving problems that need to be solved.
To fall in love with space is to fall in love with science. Yes, I concur as a science journalist. And joining Catherine at this special Sydney Science Festival event at the Powerhouse Museum on Gadigal Country are Koichi Wakata, the first Japanese commander of the International Space Station, who's clocked up a total of 504 days in space over four missions since the early 1990s. He now works for the private company Axiom Space. NASA's chief astronaut, Joseph Acaba, who has spent 306 days in space across three missions. He's been chosen as a member of the team of astronauts eligible to fly in the NASA Artemis mission to the moon. Hungarian mechanical engineer and mission specialist Tibor Kalpu, who's recently returned from his first mission into space. And they're speaking to the tech journalist and host of ABC Radio National's Download This Show, Wiradjuri woman Ray Johnston. Take it away, Ray.
Now, I don't think there is a single person in this room, myself very much included, that hasn't been completely excited and in awe at astronauts from a very early age. So it is an absolute privilege to be here to speak directly to people who have seen Earth from orbit, who have trained in deserts and oceans and launched into space and shuttles and capsules and commercial flights, people who are shaping what human spaceflight will look like in the years ahead. Very exciting times. It's about the science, yes, but it's also about the experience, the human experience. Now, space travel is something that has captured our imagination since before we even knew it would ever be possible. Right now, why is human spaceflight more relevant than ever? Not just scientifically, but also culturally.
So I could say a lot of things. I will just say one, so I will give the chance to my dear friend Koichi and all the others. When you were mentioning that you were in awe of astronauts from a young age, this is Koichi for me. Well, anyway, on a slightly less brighter note, I think in 2025 there is a lot of division. Countries are divided. nations might be divided, countries amongst themselves could be divided. So we need all of the topics that can unite people. I've flown to space very recently. I just came back from space after 20 days on the 15th of July. So I have a super recent experience, and maybe we'll talk about it later, but how my country reacted, that was none less than unifying. It was a shared experience between Hungarians. It was an awesome feeling for both of me and for them as well. It can be compared to other topics like sports and others and scientific fields, which are topics that a whole nation can stand behind. So all of a sudden, after my launch, and I've been speaking from orbit to my mom and my dad, they have been saying that I suddenly became everyone's son. Everyone knows me from somewhere in Hungary. I'm related to everyone suddenly. So it might be funny. But the thing is that no matter what they think about the word, no matter what, political agenda may they have or anything, there are topics which can unite people. And spaceflight is, human spaceflight especially, is definitely one of them.
Oichi, what's your experience there with why spaceflight is important now?
I totally agree with Thibault. When you see the beautiful home planet from space, you don't see any boundaries separating the countries, and you really feel that we are one world. The Earth is one world, and we are one people. And this is not the geopolitical issues only, but environmental issues. There are so many issues that we have to resolve, and we have to work as one citizen of the Earth. We encounter a lot of issues of space station, space shuttle systems. For example, we have an oxygen generator or CO2 carbon dioxide removal system. And whenever you have a toilet issue, toilet is very important. We have to fix it right away. If you don't have the oxygen generator, it means you die pretty soon. So we have to quickly fix it. So whenever we encounter any issues, we fix it. But when you look at the beautiful home planet, it is like a big spaceship, Earth. And there's a CO2 removal system called Forest. And then if you destroy those things, then eventually it means, death of the creatures. So we have to fix it. So by living in a very close environment and spaceship, you have to fix certain things if it's critical. Then you can really apply that to the nature or the environment of the Earth. And this is only possible by working together. Every country has a responsibility, and we have to work together because we are the only one citizen of the home planet. So that's the spirit I think that I always cherish, and I hope many people will do the same.
It's an incredible perspective there, yeah. Joseph, how about you?
Wow, this is a tough panel with these good answers, and I'm sandwiched here. He is the man.
He's the boss.
I'm the boss. He's the man. So, if you look back at the early stages of space exploration, it was done by just a few countries. It was not like it is today and like we need to have in the future. That, there's a saying, if you want to go fast, you go alone, but if you want to go far, you have to go together. And I think that's where we are today, is we do want to go farther than we've ever gone before, and no one country can do that. And it's exemplified with the International Space Station. It's also, we had the original astronauts, but now we have the private astronaut missions. There are more opportunities. I see students out here. Anybody want to be an astronaut? Anybody? I see some hands coming up. If you ever get a chance, take it, because it's awesome.
Thanks, Joseph.
I highly recommend it. But when we go back to the moon, when we go to Mars, it is not going to be one country. It is going to be an international collaboration, and that's why today is just an exciting time in history.
Catherine, how about for you? Why is space flight important today?
I don't know if it's better to go first or last in the queue, but I absolutely agree with everyone else on the panel. And everyone, thank you for coming today. It's a pleasure to have the chance to talk with all of you, and also for me to listen to Thibault, Koichi and Joe, and to speak with Ray again. I'm definitely the rookie on this panel. They've all been to space, in some cases multiple times, so I'm probably more excited than you to hear what they have to say. For me,
why is spaceflight important, especially today? I absolutely agree with what they've all said. Science, species-level discovery is a unifier. It's something that everyone can agree on, and it's a way that we can find common threads to cooperate and discuss and have shared pride around the world, whether it's with like-minded countries or non-like-minded countries, and the International Space Station is evidence of that actually already happening. But to take it further, around the world today, we have a lot of challenges. I think we all know that, whether it's climate, whether it's human society and quality of life, emergencies and so on, or political, we need to have more STEM professionals. We need to have more people that can identify and solve problems and have the tools to be able to do that as a society and to have a STEM literate society. And what human spaceflight does is it is a gateway for many young people to fall in love with science, to fall in love with innovating and being creative and being empowered to be at that forefront of discovery and solving problems that need to be solved. In Australia, 7 out of 10 kids under 12 want to go to space, which is remarkable. So I carry a lot of hopes and dreams on my shoulders, no pressure. But something goes pretty wrong in high school. This year, we've had the lowest ever enrollments in maths, in higher maths ever. We've got the lowest level enrollments in maths across the board ever. And young girls only make up like 38% of that, right? Less than 4% of engineers in Australia are Australian-born women as well. So I think there's a bridge to be built there using space. I've been able to get out and about across the country since I came home from my astronaut training. And I can tell you that, you know, potential and curiosity is everywhere. It's incredible to see the light in kids' eyes when they talk about wanting to explore space, that ancient feeling, that curiosity you get when you look under a rock to find a bug or climb a tree to look out at the view. That's that same feeling all kids have, and I hope as adults we don't lose, because it's that feeling that's led humans to want to explore and understand our world and also to explore and understand space. I've got 2 kids. I go to my fair share of kids' parties, and I've never seen a kid dress up as a blockchain or like as an AI, right? But you do have a lot of astronauts. So it's that personification of science, and I hope to be able to support there as well. And there's also all the capability elements, you know, as astronauts, from those I've had the pleasure of meeting and working with, what I understand is that astronauts, you know, are willing to put their lives on the line because we believe in the power of the discoveries and the importance of the work we do up there. It's not going up there for fun to take a selfie. It's going up there to do work you can't do on the Earth in any other way.
Maybe we need to rebrand it as Space Maths. You reckon that would work?
Put space in the front, right?
Just put space in front of it. Makes everything cooler. We've been over this. Now, Joseph, as NASA's chief astronaut, you're now shaping the next generation through the Artemis program. Can you tell us all what the Artemis program hopes to achieve, returning astronauts to the moon? Very exciting. What are they going to do up there, though?
It's going to be great, and I'm very excited about it. You know, when I was the age of some of these kids out here, I was watching the Apollo missions that were happening. Yes, I am that old. And, you know, that was an inspiration to me. And so the Artemis program, you know, kind of in a nutshell, it's NASA's program with collaboration with our international partners, with commercial companies to go back to the moon, but now to stay, to make it sustainable for us to explore. We're gonna learn, we're gonna innovate, and we are going to inspire. And we are going back. We have the Artemis II mission that will launch in early next year. The crew is excited, they are ready to go. So we're gonna learn at the moon through the Artemis program, and from there we're gonna continue out to Mars. And we are going to explore like we never have before. And it's exciting, it's cool, be paying attention next year. But again, when we go, it is that international collaboration. We are gonna have everybody involved with it, and it's gonna be awesome.
It's exciting times. Now, Catherine, as the first astronaut under the Australian flag, Can you take us through what that path looked like for you? Because we've had Australian astronauts before, but this is something different, right? How does this happen?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge honour to be a recently qualified astronaut, better yet, an Australian astronaut. When I grew up here in Sydney, I grew up in Curlie on the Northern Beaches, and the sky was full of stars, and I was just mesmerised by that, and I was drawn in by that childhood curiosity, wanting to get up close to planets no one ever had before. And as I grew up, I fell in love with science, and I quickly saw that Australia didn't even have a space agency, let alone a pathway to being an astronaut. But I was a young, stubborn kid, and that didn't hold me back. At school, I was asked to write down three things I wanted to be when I grew up, and I just wrote astronaut three times because what else is there? And my school, instead of, you know, saying that was ridiculous, they said, well, go figure out what that would take, probably hoping that would show me a bit of sense. And here I saw it was unlikely, but I saw that to be an astronaut, you could be a scientist, you could be an engineer, you could be a pilot, you could be a doctor, you should have expeditionary experience, stuff like military service or going to Antarctica or scientific field work. You should have operational skills, whether from your day job, say as a surgeon or a pilot, or with strong hobbies in that, and a bunch of other things. And I thought, well, that sounds pretty great. Like, what's the downside? And I chose to pursue engineering and science in the end. I went for science, but I added engineering because it had the word space in the title, space engineering. I didn't know what engineering was. I didn't know an engineer. And actually, that remains the biggest barrier to young women becoming engineers today, knowing what it is. And I'm so glad I did, because it took me all around the world to work on some of the most compelling missions I could have ever hoped to work on, launching rockets in the north of Scandinavia, gravity wave detection missions, human spaceflight missions, and so on. And during that time, I was so inspired by looking to people like Paul Scully Power and Andy Thomas, Australians that had been to space before representing the US, but doing wonderful outreach work in Australia. And I saw that they made their career overseas. So that's what I thought I would have to do. So for me to now represent Australia is an absolutely huge honour. And I'm excited, not just for me, but for what I think it can do for our country to unlock access to this really opaque world, quite frankly, for our scientists and our researchers and our companies, and I hope accelerate the time to when we have more Australian astronauts.
What does having an astronaut under the Australian flag mean for this country's place in human spaceflight? What does it change?
I think it's huge. I think, you know, to have a country represented in human spaceflight is evidence of the maturity of the space sector and the capability of the country. When an astronaut goes to space, they go to space with a suite of experiments, payloads from their country. They can be science payloads, they can be technology demonstrators, they can be educational payloads. Often flights can be paid for through something that's called barter. So sometimes rather than, say, paying for a ticket, you can contribute something. Canada contributes a huge robotic arm on the space station, for example. And it, I think, just uplifts the level of aspiration for young people. You know, astronauts are seen as that pinnacle of a STEM career. In reality, we're not better than anyone, we just fit a particular box, but it's so aspirational that it helps to remove that tall poppy layer in a country too. So for Australia, I hope that this helps to shine a light on all of the capability we have here at home in our space sector and beyond, and creates new avenues for cooperation. I can tell you, when I was in Europe and then briefly in the US for training, everyone was so delighted to see Australia stepping up. There's so much potential across our country for us to be contributing even further from our research and adjacent sectors and space sectors, and I hope that this helps with that too.
She is a passionate advocate for the power of science, and as this year's Australian of the Year, astronaut Catherine Bunnell-Pegg. She's not wasting time, and she's joining you on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today at this Astronauts Forum at Sydney's Powerhouse Museum. Hello, Natasha Mitchell with you too, alongside NASA's Chief Astronaut, American Joseph Akaba, the first Japanese commander of the International Space Station, Koichi Wakata, and still brushing off the stardust from his very first space mission, Hungarian Tibor Kaupu. There with host, my ABC Radio National colleague from Download This Show, Ray Johnston.
So for all of you, the training to become an astronaut is pretty intense. You know, it's long. You're doing all sorts of strange things in these simulated extreme environments. What was the most challenging part of that training, and was it what you expected it to be? Tibor, I'll start with you.
So we Hungarians, we did it a little bit special way. And that was because, it's no joke, unfortunately. That was because we started our selection process at a certain point in 2022 with a couple of hundred people. We got down to four guys. Obviously, I'm sitting on the stage alone as a Hungarian, so four is too much for us, or four is too many for us. So they decided that these four guys as astronaut candidates, we will do the basic training, but we will still down select to two. And I was the lucky one, coming out as a lucky guy at the end of that selection. And I also had a backup guy. So out of the four, we down selected to two. So we did 14 months as a basic training, but still part of the selection. And that's not necessarily a good thing, because imagine four young guys in Hungary who are competing against sort of like each other, but mainly against themselves, because we knew that comparing an apple to a pear, it's really tricky. So they didn't really tell us what you have to be growing at, but we knew that we have to come out better than we started the whole thing. So you have to develop, you have to grow. So probably that will be measurable in your statistics or in your data. And hopefully that will be a good thing at the end. So that was the reason that they included some innovative elements. Like we went to isolation, meaning that the four of us and then one commander from the military, we were 6 days in containers. We were simulating the ISS environment. So there was no sun touching our skin, no air or wind touching our skin, and no water touching our skin, because on the ISS you use hygiene towels when you are showering. So, and we were simulating that for 6 days. There were false fire alarms. We didn't sleep too much. During the day, we were conducting the premature experiments that we were working on at that time. So that was tricky, but the good thing is that you learn a lot about yourself. I mean, if I don't do the astronaut training and the astronaut selection, I would never go for 6 days of isolation for sure by myself. But I was, I think, self-confident. And when I came out, I could say a lot of other things about myself, which I didn't know before. So you learn a lot. So that's one thing. And quickly, another thing regarding innovative things. Hungarians also came up with the plan that we should put these guys in aerobatic planes and also fighter jets. So when they are pulling 7 Gs with you, 7 Gs meaning that 7 times your body weight is compressed on your either your chest or your head or something, because the fighter jet and the aerobatic machines can pull such maneuvers that it will be, putting those high forces, high accelerations on your body. It's not fun. They say it's fun. It sounds fun. It is fun. After my first fighter jet experience, I came out with such a sweaty suit that it was basically equivalent as if I was going to a pool. It's completely the same. I was wet everywhere, literally everywhere. So because you struggle a lot, you use your muscles to keep your blood in your brain. It's a whole thing. So even though that I became a pilot during the training as well, we've acquired our light aircraft pilot license. We did also this extreme piloting and isolation, and there were some challenging times for sure.
Koichi, what about you? What was challenging for you that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, very good question. I think everything was challenging for me. All the, spacecraft, robotics, team building, and spacewalking training, everything is really challenging. But for me, the most challenging thing was, I'm Japanese, and I grew up only speaking in Japanese. So for me, the most challenging thing was speaking in English and the training. Because when I was selected in 1992 as a national candidate from the Japanese Space Agency, I was sent over to Houston. And we had 19 Americans in our class of 24, 19 Americans, two Canadians, two Europeans. By the way, Andy Thomas was my classmate from Adelaide, Australia. So he was wonderful. And I was the youngest in the class of the 24. So they gave me a pacifier that and that had a flag. That had a flag that said the remove before flight, so I removed it before I flew. But anyway, so I did not speak English very well, but I really appreciated the NASA astronaut office who welcomed somebody like me. And I had a hard time, even no matter how much I study of the space shuttle systems, I just don't understand what they're saying in the simulator with the four of us in ascent or launch simulation. But my colleagues of NASA, including Andy Thomas, were very kind and gave me, you know, extra hours to explain what was happening. And, you know, Thibault was talking about the fighter jet training, but we have NASA T-38, the training aircraft, high-performance jet training aircraft, but I didn't understand what they were saying. And if traffic controller or my pilots were saying, but so my colleague pilots of my classmates, they spent extra hours at night to fly with me so that I can feel more comfortable. But the once you, by the way, when I was flying on the T-38 to some destination from Houston to El Paso, I flew with the legendary moonwalker, John Young, Captain John Young, who walked on the moon, who actually flew six times, the Gemini, and then Apollo 10, Apollo 16, walked on the moon, and first space shuttle commander, John Young, and then he flew on STS-9, so six times. But I was flying on a NASA jet with John Young, and then some air traffic controller was saying, and then so John, I don't. So I'm talking with my, you know, moonwalker. I mean, John, I don't know what he's saying. And John said, I don't either. So that was wow. Even if you can walk on the moon, you don't understand what's it. So that was a very confidence builder. So I really am very thankful to my NASA colleagues who was helping me to boost. But once you learn how to learn a foreign language, you can apply the same thing to different languages. Because I flew on a Soyuz spacecraft, that's a Russian spacecraft. So you have to read everything in speaking in Russian language. All the procedures are all Russian language. So I apply the same way when I learned the Russian language. So, you know, English was so hard, but once you, you know, overcome the hardship, you can apply the same kind of methodology to learn something new. So, you know, you have to remember when you are struggling something and when you try out something, that's the time that you are, I think, growing the most efficiently. So that's what I learned when it comes to the language. So there are so many technical things that I had a hard time, but for me, English was the hardest.
Well, your English is amazing now. So obviously you have mastered that. That's why he is the man. I am very grateful that I'm not a Hungarian astronaut because you're selection and training sounds terrible, okay? We don't abuse our folks quite like that. I'm learning a lot up here. So for me, before I became an astronaut, I was a school teacher. Any teachers out here? Yeah. You all are the best. You know, nothing but high regard when I was teaching. I thought that's what I would do forever. I heard about this thing called NASA, and maybe they might want to hire some educators to become full-time astronauts. We had Kristen McAuliffe that was an educator, and she was going to fly to space once and then come back, and then she was involved with the Challenger accident, so we lost Krista. And so in 2003, they wanted to build on her legacy and hire educators to become full-time astronauts, so not just one flight and then to come back. And so I went from being the teacher, you know, the one that's like, you're supposed to be the smartest one in the room, but not always the case. And so I went from being the teacher to now being the student. And when you're 30 years old, being a student again, it's hard. You know, you are struggling every day. And for me, there's not one thing that's hard about being an astronaut. It's the amount of things that we have to learn. Like Koichi said, you got to learn how to do a spacewalk. You got to learn how to fly in a jet. When I went to interview, I didn't know what pitch, yaw, and roll was. You know, they said, you're going to have a robotics test, so you should know what this is. And I said, what is that? And so luckily, I had a friend who had this flight. I won't call it a flight simulator. It was just like a CD where you could see like an airplane flying around. And it gave me an opportunity to figure out what is pitch, yaw, and roll. And so that's what was difficult, is the amount of information that we have to learn. And so it gave me a greater appreciation for what it's like to be a student. And it's a struggle every day. I mean, we're learning all of the time. But when you're doing something you love and you're studying something that you love, it's not work. It's like you like going there every day and you like coming in at night over the weekends to get better because you love what you're doing. And just want to say thank you to all the educators out there, because I wouldn't be here. These students wouldn't be here without you. So thank you.
So for me, I did my training with the European Space Agency in Germany. And when you're selected to be an astronaut representing your country these days, you usually do something called like astronaut basic training or astronaut candidate training. And it takes somewhere between 1 and 2 years. For us, it was 13 months. And if you pass it, if you get through that gauntlet at the end, that's when you get your wings patch and you can call yourself an astronaut representing your country. But astronauts today have to be all-rounders. We don't usually specialize in the same way they did in the shuttle era, because most missions are longer duration missions to the huge, big, beautiful International Space Station, which is like the size of a soccer field almost. And you're up there so long, you need to be able to handle almost any kind of work. So you are a scientist in the sky, you're the hands, the eyes of your country's scientists on the ground. You're a medical researcher and a lab tech and their test subject. You're a space tradie. There's no gems come fix the ISS toilet. You've got to do it yourself. And you're also a science communicator, and the list goes on. So we learned so much stuff in these 13 months. We had, I think it was 323 instructors, I was told, and I was like a kid in a candy shop. Like, there was so much to learn, but I had to learn to pace myself and keep enough energy for the next day and the next, because it's a marathon, not a sprint. And definitely for me, learning Russian was the hardest. A lot of the other European astronauts spoke multiple languages. And I was sitting there and I remember like tuning into what the teacher was saying, and she goes like, "Katya idiot." And I was like, "What?" And it's like, "Catherine goes," right? And yeah, it was an interesting challenge, but wonderful to have the chance to learn something in that way. On the first day of the training, I remember walking into the European Astronaut Centre. They asked my class, six of us, we're called the Hoppers, to walk in at the same time. And I saw all these astronauts there that I had looked up to for most of my career, welcoming us as part of the team. And that was so special. But we all had a real tough time at lunch with conversation, us ASCANs and the new astronauts, because we'd all speed read their autobiographies in the selection. And we knew far too much. In the winter survival course, people had a little bit of fun with me because I asked too many questions about wildlife in the prep. And so they told me about the bears and the wolves, where we were. And we had to spend a couple of nights out by ourselves individually in the middle of the woods. And once you'd set up your snow cave and found, cooked your food, set up for the night, I made sure to, you know, hoist everything up high into the trees. But yeah, that was totally unnecessary. And the next day everyone came and laughed at me. So yeah, it's all fun. You're all there as part of a team. One of the best things was an astronaut training. Everyone's got such a different background and you all have different strengths and weaknesses. You can't compare yourself to others and you help each other get through it. And that was awesome.
She is living her childhood dreams. The 2026 Australian of the Year, Catherine Bunnell-Pegg, on Big Ideas Today on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen as podcast. G'day, Natasha Mitchell. Really loving this conversation I'm joining you for today. Astronauts are plenty at this event from Sydney's Powerhouse Museum. With more than 800 mission days between them, we've got veterans, Joseph Acaba from NASA, Koichi Wakata from Axiom Space, as well as young gun Tibor Kaupu. And from space fashion to phoning home from the ISS, the International Space Station, this audience is hungry to know more. So let's hand back to host ABC Radio National's technology journalist, Ray Johnston.
I'm incredibly grateful that we've been given a few more minutes on the clock over here, because there are 230 questions from you all. I am so sorry. We are not going to get through them all. I think you can find all these guys on social media and hit them up with all your questions. But let's start with the top one. What is one skill or piece of knowledge you've gained from astronaut training or time in space that you find surprisingly useful in your everyday life back on Earth?
Fixing the plumbing at home.
Fixing plumbing?
Yes, absolutely.
I don't know. I would say, you know, something that you don't think about on a regular basis is communication. Communication is extremely important, especially when you're on an expedition, either to the International Space Station, some of the analog training that we do. If you have somebody, I don't know, who never washes their spoon and they leave it on the table every day, and it drives you crazy because you're a clean freak. This is not me, but I'm just, it's an example. Just an example. But if that bothers you and you don't communicate that to your crewmate after days and weeks and months, you're going to want to do something to your crewmate. And so you do have to give feedback. You have to communicate with your crewmates. And I think that's a skill that, you know, we need every day of our lives, is learning how to communicate, be honest with people, and it just makes for a much better expedition. And I think as a world, we need to communicate. We don't all agree. We have our differences, but it's that communication that is extremely important.
I'll go to another question here. What role do private companies like SpaceX play in assisting international space agencies with future missions, especially in rocket recycling and efficiency? Someone knows their stuff.
I can take that one. Because I'm in the private sector. Originally, I was in the government side of the business. Japanese Space Agency was my home agency, but now I retired from that and I'm working for Axiom Space. And we are leading this human spaceflight missions to the ISS. And then we are building the new space station. But I think what's important is the balance between the government-led program and the commercially-led program. Of course, in a commercial programs, things could go more efficiently because you have to make money, and then you have to be quick and fast. At the same time, safety is very important. And then by having this commercially-led program, eventually we can do a lot of human space programs, including the government business, more efficiently, more timely manner. So I think both the balance is very important. By having this commercial company working to make an efficient and a safe spacecraft, spacesuit, that will help the government programs to go beyond low Earth orbit to the Moon and Mars more efficiently and most hopefully more quickly.
Is aesthetics considered in designing spacecraft or space stations, or is it purely functionally driven design?
Well, we know some stories. Coming back to the first previous question, SpaceX, we know for a fact that that guy said that it should be pointy. So, so there's a reason why SpaceX rockets look like that, which is awesome, actually. Like, I fell in love with that technology. They do such a great job. In fact, because of SpaceX's reusable rockets, spaceflight became 10 times cheaper in the past 10 or 15 years, which is crazy to think about. Actually, me as an astronaut from the Hunor program, Hunor goes for Hungarian to orbit, I could have not to fly to space because paying 10 times more for something, probably maybe our decision makers would have gone another way. So there is aesthetics, which I think is a good thing because it can inspire people. It can bring in other fields of science or art, actually. Designers can actually work on space now. They have a chance to collaborate to a field where they were not maybe super emphasized before that. But I want to say something else as well. I was flying with Axiom Space. Koichi is working for that company. They are developing a spacesuit, and that will be the spacesuit which will be used for the next time an American sets foot on the moon. So this is a very special spacesuit because a company who is a private company developing that, they have the chance to collaborate with other companies. So that spacesuit will be contributed by Prada, which is something that you could not imagine 10 years ago, for sure. The visor of that spacesuit, you know, that the layer that protects you against the sun, which I would definitely need now, but that's all right. That will be contributing by Oakley. I was really trying to convince those guys that I think a Nike boots would be pretty cool on that, but they're not there yet. But just imagine these kind of collaborations, which were definitely not possible 10 years ago. And this means that companies that are producing high quality products on their fields now have the chance to collaborate with space companies, which is, I think, the multiplicator effect of that is huge, and it will inspire even more people.
Maybe if I could just add to that, that spacesuit that's being made at Axiom, I had the pleasure to see the production line of it in Houston, and I was amazed to see the machine that cuts the material. It has to be super precise and 3D, and it's an Australian machine. So when you see the suit, yeah. It actually comes from the sailing industry and cutting sails. But so when you see this suit around the station, future stations, and on the moon, you know, it's Australian technology that made it possible, which I'm super proud of.
Awesome, awesome. Got another question here. How do astronauts cope with loneliness or being away from Earth for so long? Are there strategies? Are you trained on it? Do you get, you know, put in a container by yourself? What happens here?
It's not as lonely as you would think, especially on the International Space Station. I actually saw my parents more in space than I do today, because we would have a private family conference every week. And it was a video conference, and so it was scheduled. Every Sunday, I would see them. And so, which is, you know, was nice. And, you know, we also have the most amazing telephone ever, where we can call anywhere on Earth, as long as we have a satellite signal, but nobody can call you. It's the best. So you can reach out. And I had a friend of mine where I called, of course, and went to voicemail. I'm like, hey, Juan, what's up? This is Joe from the ISS, just saying hello. And, you know, he looked at the number that was dialed. He calls it back and says, hey, I'm trying to get a hold of Joe. He just called me. And the operator's like, are you crazy? What? We can't do that. So the loneliness, I think, on the space station is not too problematic. I think what we have to think about now is the psychological effect when we're going off to Mars, and where now we can see Earth every day from the space station. And we know we could be home within a few hours if we had to. When we do the analog training, if you're underwater, you can come up at any time. If you're in a cave, you can come out. But when you start going to Mars, and now Earth is a star, and you know you're not coming back for, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, I think that's something psychologically that we're going to have to work on and be prepared for. And I don't know how you do that. I don't think we want to be in a box for a couple of years. And again, with that analog training, you can always open the door and come out. So I think that's going to be a struggle that we're just going to have to learn and see how we deal with that.
Thank you for unlocking a new fear, Joseph. That's fantastic. I appreciate you.
Psychologically, what's most important, another thing that is very important is the food item. And because even if you cannot communicate when you go to Mars, it takes 20 minutes, you know, for the signal to reach, so you cannot have a conversation. But I think if you have your home cooking or home food from, your home country, that would be great. I really enjoyed having the Japanese rice and the fish and all kinds of things. And this morning, Catherine took us on a tour, and then this is the first time that I had the Vegemite sandwich. And it was awesome. And so I cannot wait to see her, you know, eating a Vegemite sandwich in space.
You but fed the same everyone thing. Vegemite, because, didn't you? This is what you're doing.
Eat everyone Vegemite. Yeah.
Well done. But you did it properly.
Yeah, I got some great pastries. Got some Cole's Finest Vegemite and cheese scrolls.
It was awesome.
Some others and fed it. Yeah.
Back to the questions. I'm watching this clock countdown. We've now got 250 questions. This is not helpful. Okay, so How do you resolve arguments between astronauts in space?
So we learned a lot from NASA, actually, when we were training with them in Houston. One of the therapists, or I think that was her role, she said that when people from such different countries and nations, but actually any people who works such closely together for such a long time, it's not a question of if something, you know, distracting will happen or something argument will happen, but a question of when. So it's just basically inevitable. And it happened with us as well a week later. So it was fortunate we could use our recent experience and the recent learnings. And I think it's a very good thing. And we applied it many times, fortunately, during training, and we didn't have to do it in orbit. What I call is a snowball effect. So when a snowball comes down on a mountain, you should catch it before it becomes a huge sphere at a time when it's only a snowball. It's like a snowball. Meaning that if you have any indication that something is going wrong, as Joe mentioned as well, you shouldn't wait until the last moment, but address it. I'm not saying super quickly. Maybe you should think about some words, wordings and phrasings, probably, which we did. but addressing these problems quickly is a huge thing. That was the same class, actually, when we learned that crumbles, like pastry crumbles, can cause the biggest problems on ISS. And that's not only because it, you know, gets into the filters and equipment will be broken because everything floats, of course, in space, but also because food, as Koichi mentioned, it's a social thing and it, you know, reminds you of home. But also if you steal others' foods, that will cause a big problem. So crumbles, like, it will, yeah, that's a tricky thing. So, yeah, it's... There are some methods.
I've got another question here. What's it like to return back to Earth after a period of time in space? What does it do to you physically as well as emotionally? I'm curious.
Yeah. So after you spend some time in zero gravity, actually, we exercise every day, so you have enough strength, but your vestibular organs is so used to this zero gravity. When you come back, it's a different kind of environment. So it takes a few days, you know, for you to get the balance back. But, you know, we have enough strength because of the wonderful exercise device on board, but everything feels so heavy. When you lie on the bed, it's really difficult to move your legs. And then in space, it's very easy. If I want to fly there, I can just push here and then go. So I always dreamed of, after coming back from space, and when you're lying on the bed, I can just push the bed, I can fly, but it doesn't fly anymore. So that's kind of a strange feeling. But it takes a while to get used to be back to this zero gravity. But the human can adapt to new environment really quickly.
I'm told that if you want to embarrass a recently returned astronaut, you try and get them to catch something, right? Because in space, things go in straight lines, and on Earth, they have a curve, so they just can't catch. Yeah.
That's great. Okay, so space travel is very experimental, this question asks. Have you ever been afraid for your life? How do you overcome this fear?
Well, I guess if you're going to space, you got to be a little bit crazy. And and you fear for your life, but it's in a controlled environment. And, you know, we learn to mitigate and control the risk that we face. But I will say, you know, the first time that I did a spacewalk and, you know, you're floating in the space station, you feel very comfortable, you can see the Earth a couple hundred miles away. But the first time that you do a spacewalk and you come outside of the space station, the Earth hasn't gone, you know, farther away, but it sure feels like it. And, you know, we actually have in our procedures where we have a couple of minutes just to, you know, let go of the handrails. You put a tether down so you don't float away, because that would be bad. And so you hook yourself up and then you just let go for a minute to convince your brain that you are not going to fall to Earth a couple hundred miles away. And I won't lie, it was a little scary. But exciting, and now you're outside the protection of the space station, but it's worth it.
Great answer. Another question here. What is the single most important personal trait that an astronaut needs to have in your experience? Personal trait.
I think, is it okay? So Joe mentioned this communication, but I think what's also very important is self-care. This is something that I learned from this, what's called the expeditionary training, like a mountain climbing or underwater facility for a week. We call this training, analogous to the space environment training. But you have to clean your, you know, spoons in your bed. And that is something to make it tidy means that will make other people feel comfortable living with you. And actually, I made my wife feel comfortable by applying to that, methodology. So my wife really appreciates it. And then, so this self-care is something that is very important in human space flight. And but not only in human space flight, but in the daily life, in the family and everything. So that's what I learned through this astronaut training.
And the only thing I would add, another trait, we just got done selecting 10 new astronauts. And we went through, you know, tons of interviews, talking to people. And so you have to be technically competent, but I would say one of the most important features and what you need to be an astronaut is you need to be humble and you need to be nice. You can be the best test pilot, the best geologist, the smartest engineer, but if you're not a nice human being, you're going to be a terrible teammate. So humility and just being nice, and I think that's a trait we can use not just in space but every day.
I've got a tricky question in the limited time that we have left. What is the benefit of spending money and time trying to make Mars habitable when the exact same science and techniques can be used to rehabilitate the Earth?
Anybody?
You have 24 seconds.
I'm sure everybody has everybody has different probably thoughts on that. Just something very quickly is when we explore space, we are learning, we are advancing technologies. And so when we look at going to the moon, going to Mars, we are going to learn things that are going to help us here on Earth. And that's really a huge benefit of space exploration that a lot of times is missed, not realizing what those benefits are for humanity back on Earth.
I could maybe add to that with some examples. We know about the greenhouse effect because we went to explore Venus. When we go back to the moon, we're going to be looking at the geology of the moon in far more detail, and that's going to teach us about what's underneath the Earth's surface, which is going to help us have better inputs into Earth-based climate change models because the geothermal inputs aren't as high fidelity as some of the other inputs. And there's that intentional research, and then there's the surprise outcomes as well. And I think you have to justify space on the intentional research, but the spin-outs, you have a phenomenal. If you look back at Apollo in the US, for every US dollar invested, there was somewhere between 5 and 7 that were returned. So it's not just science and discovery, it's economic input and jobs, and has a bigger effect. So yeah, we explore space for the Earth, not in spite of it.
Exactly. Yes, we go to space to look back at Earth and study about Earth. We go to Mars because we know that there was water there. We know there was rivers there and lakes there. And that's the closest planet to us where we know these environments. So there's the best chance to find life. As soon as we find life or any signs of life that maybe happened to be in Mars, then we know that those stuff that needed to establish life, that's not only specific to Earth. That is basically almost the holy grail of space exploration, to find life somewhere else. So that's one of the key factors. And the other thing is, it might sound scary, but to make life and Earth, humans, multiplanetary, that makes us, you know, much more safe in the long term. I think it's far ahead. It's a long shot. But I was talking to Julie, another astronaut, a few days ago, and she said that when you go to space, eventually you have to come back. Right? Earth is our spaceship. We have a lot of sayings about this, but even you go up there, you come back eventually. When you go to Mars, we will reach that time when you don't really have to come back. That can become another home. So Earth will always be our primary home and our primary spaceship, but we as humanity, we as species, we have actually much better chances if we can extend and we just have our bases on two places and not only one.
Please join me in thanking our panel, everyone. Fantastic conversation.
Out of this world and living their best lives, right? Astronauts Koichi Wakata, Joseph Akaba, Tibor Kaupu and Catherine Bennell Pegg, the 2026 Australian of the Year. Ray Johnston from ABC Radio National's Media, Culture and Technology podcast, Download This Show, Check It Out, was the host. And big thanks to Sydney's Powerhouse Museum and that very enthusiastic Sydney Science Festival audience. Speaking of space, if you haven't caught the new series of the Science Friction podcast, which I used to host, it's all about the gripping and tragic space and engineering tale of the Challenger disaster, hosted by Dr. Carl and Fiona Pepper. And you can catch it all now on ABC Listen. Look for Science Friction and look for Big Ideas as well. Next on the show, what's the apparent backlash against the hard-fought for rights of LGBTIQ plus people about? That's coming up next. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Our email address for all the bows and all the brickbats, bigideas@abc.net.au. We love hearing from you. Ciao for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.